Good morning, everyone. If I'm right, we're at the bottom of page 675. Line 164, if you have the line numbers. But before we start, I had to do some more research this last week. Chico asked, she was puzzled. We have the word God with a capital G. We have also God and gods with a small g. And we have Godhead. And she said she'd looked in the dictionary and it wasn't very helpful. She asked, what is the difference between these different terms? So first of all, God. And I found a quotation from The Life Divine, which is maybe helpful to us to understand the difference between these terms. He says, the nodus of life, the knot or center of life, is the relation between three general forms of consciousness. The individual, the universal, and the transcendent or supracosmic. In the ordinary distribution of life's activities, the individual regards himself as a separate being, included in the universe, and both individual and universe, as dependent upon that which transcends alike the universe and the individual. It is to this transcendence that we currently give the name of God.
With a capital G.
So God, if you look in the dictionary, it gives many definitions, and in Savitri, Sri Aurobindo uses many terms for this supreme being. The Purushottama, the eternal, the infinite,
the absolute,
the omniscient, the omnipotent, the creator and maintainer of the universe, the one who pervades and inhabits the universe while being utterly free of all limitations, the transcendent origin of everything that is. To which to our minds is the unknowable, ultimately unknowable. Gods, who may come with a big or a small g, on the contrary, are cosmic or universal personalities or powers put forth by the divine, by God. Sri Aurobindo says they are therefore limited emanations. Although the full divine is behind each of them. Each of these gods has his independent, cosmic or universal standing, function and work in the universe. He says in the overmind and the triple world, that is our world, they appear as independent beings. They return in the supermind into the one and stand there united in a single harmonious action as multiple personalities of the one person. The divine Purushottama. We can think of the gods as the cosmic powers and personalities, as he says, that work for the furtherance of the divine purpose. They are powers and personalities, individualized forms of the divine, to work on a universal scale. Then we have
like Indra and all these people come into that category.
Yes.
That's what the Lakshmi.
Yes. Yes. And then there's this word Godhead, which he uses many times in the poem. Sometimes with an article, we can speak about a Godhead or the Godhead of this or that or the other. Or sometimes he uses it just without an article, Godhead. So there's a slightly different meaning if it's with an article. If it's with an article, it's a divine being, an individual expression of the divine. In Savitri, Sri Aurobindo uses this word, for example, for the dawn goddess. On life's thin border, the Godhead stood. And he uses it for the God of love also. But often, this is the most common use in the poem, he uses it for the evolving divinity in human beings and in the human race. We have a Godhead growing in us. And without any article, Godhead means the state or nature of divinity. So I've got some examples here. They are all rather close together. I didn't look very far. He writes of the crown of conscious immortality, the Godhead promised to our struggling souls when first man's heart dared death and suffered life. Or he speaks of Aswapati, or the seer. He sees within the face of deity. The Godhead breaks out through the human mold. And then elsewhere he says, the maker, the creator, shall recast us and impose a plan of Godhead on the mortal's mold, lifting our finite minds to his infinite, touching the moment with eternity. And he speaks of the inhabiting soul, the traveler in time, in his world adventures, crude initial start, behold him ignorant of his Godhead's force, timid initiate of its vast design. That's in our human state, no? When we start on our world adventure, we don't know much about this growing, evolving divinity within us, and has to grow from being a timid initiate to breaking out of the human mold.
Do you have an example of the evolving one? The Godhead.
Why don't you have a look yourself?
No,
there are several hundred.
Okay.
Well, here he says, yeah. No, the Godhead promised to us the state of
is
divinity.
Yeah.
But as a child, when we were learning going to catechism's classes, I can say it in Latin.
Can you speak a little loud?
As a child, when we know what is God, qu'est-ce que Dieu? C'est Dieu est un pur esprit, infiniment parfait, créateur du ciel et de la terre, qui a toujours été et qui sera toujours. They never taught us about other.
No, in Christianity, they don't speak about the gods, for instance. Absolutely forbidden to think about that. And the idea that we ourselves are potential gods. This is blasphemy, no?
Not only in Catholicism, but in Christian.
Yes.
There's a revelation that we are all God within us, and that we are coming to be divine.
we have come from the One, and we are returning to the One. Yes. But He has chosen to express Himself in multiple souls and in all the forms of the universe. He's created the universe, not from outside, from Himself, emanated all this. So all this is divine, if we could see as He sees. Okay, Chico?
Thank you. When we were going through Savitri earlier, we also mentioned that Sri Aurobindo uses it interchangeably, sometimes capital G, sometimes small g. That also is...
Yes, as I mentioned before, after the beginning of perhaps book 5, we can't be sure whether Sri Aurobindo intended a capital or not, because it was done by dictation, and it may have depended on the scribe. So, and of course, in the most recent edition, the revised edition of 1993, one place where in part one, where the capital is used, has been removed, because they say they found manuscripts where it wasn't there. No. But some of us are very attached to that capital letter, God, the God touch. Personally, I think it's a pity if it's been removed. All can be done if the God touch is there. Yes?
Do you remember this verse? I'm not sure of the exact word in Savitri. Something like, the timeless, nameless, who saw God born.
Born, yes. Which may have a G there, a capital.
Timeless, the timeless and nameless,
who saw God born.
As if either God was a creation of man or something created, to express the relation between man and the transcendent, not the transcendent itself.
Yes. I think you are right. If we look, there's something called the divine plan. Mother says Sri Aurobindo noted it down in a certain context, almost as a joke. But he said, "I too could make my divine plan," and he did it. Yeah, in the record of yoga. Yes, and there. God definitely is not at the origin. God is, as you say, something like the highest that we can conceive. But as he said here, it's this transcendence that we currently give the name of God. He doesn't give this as a definition.
One day, Kiribai said there is the transcendent in its relation with humanity.
Yes.
And there's a transcendent plus which
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The manifestation, but the original thing is the unmanifest.
Yes.
So I wondered if that word God referred to the divine at the overmental level, because that's the home of God.
He says here, the gods in the overmind and the triple world, they appear as independent beings. This is what we call the gods. And we may use a capital G or a small g. We do it indiscriminately, I think. But they are multiple personalities of the One, the Divine Purushottama. And God, we can say, is a... although unknowable and infinite and eternal, it's a kind of personal expression of divinity. No? The creator, the this, that, or the other. So there must be there is the impersonal aspect also.
The first line of Savitri has God's with its capital G.
Yes. Yes, so there it is. That is intended, no? The hour before the gods awake. Yeah.
One expression which struck me, I don't know how long ago or even where I found it, always has stayed with me, meaning absolutely, the, I'm not sure, but the absolute reality.
Mm-hmm.
That's all, just as I say, reverberates within me of being that which is, now we're talking about
the bodiless namelessness which saw God born. So that bodiless namelessness in Indian tradition is called Brahman. It's the ultimate omnipresent reality which has taken all different forms and which to our minds is unknowable, but since we are ourselves part of that, it's not ultimately unknowable to us. We can have a contact with that bodiless namelessness.
In this context, I just want to say that Mother is very clearly about the word God. She prefers not to use it for the different misinterpretations in course of time. She says, I prefer to call
The divine.
To use the word divine.
Mm-hmm.
She never talks about God.
No.
That's why it's interesting, because it's true, God is a difficult word, because of the connotation brought by the three Abrahamic religion, they made of it something very
ugly.
Personal and oppressive.
Yes.
And I was wondering why Shrivindo would use it, I mean, without hesitation or I think he wants to give a true connotation to it.
Yes.
So not avoid it. On the contrary, would use it. Say no, it's not.
Let's use it, it's not that. Yes. Definitely when he uses it so many times in Savitri, he doesn't mean this word, that popular connotation.
But for practical purposes, like for us, it was unmanifested, but perfect in every sense. All our qualities, whatever we can think of, perfect in it, and unmanifested. We can't imagine, we can't fathom, it's endless, infinite, but perfect in every sense. Whatever thing we can think of, it's perfect.
But there too we distort. We distort the divine.
Yes.
No, we think he has to be good in the sense of good as we mean it, just loving, all that. So I think Sri Aurobindo and Mother wanted to free us from these limiting conceptions. Shall we go to the text?
Yes.
I think it's very beautiful. The word architecture. Original architect.
It's also connected, yes. But it's only one aspect, no? He speaks of the architect who built the worlds. Yeah. This is one aspect of the creator, but he's also the destroyer.
Nataraja.
Nataraja is doing both at the same time, creating and destroying. And there are these three aspects of Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, the creator, the maintainer, and the destroyer. And I think even somewhere Mother has said, no, I better not repeat it. No, I haven't got the right words, so better not to say it. Let's go to the text, safer.
Thank
you. So we're in a description of Savitri's experience in the world or the realm of everlasting day. And there in line 152 it says she saw all nature marvelous without fault. So we've been reading about these different aspects of beauty, the sound, and so on.
Maybe we start there?
we start, where do we start? Line 164, the mighty signs. Okay, we can start there. Would you like to start?
Where, which line?
It is line 152. She saw all nature. Yeah.
Page 675.
The mighty
signs. No, we are starting higher. We are starting at Margaret's suggestion. We are starting with the line, she saw all nature marvelous without fault.
She saw all nature marvelous without fault. Invaded by beauty's universal revel, her being's fiber reached out vibrating and claimed deep union with its outer selves, and on the heart's chords made pure to seize all tones, heaven's subtleties of touch unvarying force, more vivid raptures than earth's life can bear. What would be suffering here was fiery bliss, all here but passionate hint and mystic shade, divined by the inner prophet who perceives the spirit of delight in sensuous things turned to more sweetness than can now be dreamed. The mighty signs of which earth fears the stress, trembling because she cannot understand and must keep obscure in forms strange and sublime, were here the first lexicon of an infinite mind, translating the language of eternal bliss. Here, rapture was a common incident, the loveliness of whose captured thrill our human pleasure is a fallen thread, lay symbol shapes, a careless ornament, soon on the rich brocade of Godhead's dress.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything about these lines?
These mighty signs.
Yes, Patricia.
The earthquakes?
I think there might be things like earthquakes and tsunamis and things like that. Yes. Volcanoes erupting.
But she cannot understand, is
it? Earth can't understand. So she doesn't express in the material world, these things are not expressed in the same kind of way that they would be in that world, all nature perfect without fault. Because she can't understand these intensities, earth has to express them in these strange and sublime forms. They're sublime in the sense that they are so powerful and intense and beyond our scope. Here in that world of everlasting day, they are seen as like in the nursery you get, or in the nursery school or primary school, you get lists of spellings, the first lexicon. But they are expressing an infinite mind. They are translating the language of eternal bliss in a way that can be understood perhaps even by earth.
But here in this paragraph he's referring to here for this earth and past tense to what she's seen.
I think when he says we're here,
it's confusing.
No, we're here, it means in that world of everlasting day, in that expression that Savitri is experiencing there, all nature marvelous without fault.
In this sentence 159, what suffering would be here was fearing this.
That's right, but you have to be a little bit more flexible.
Yeah, but that's why it's confusing to me.
Yes, we have to be able to tell. It's one of these difficult words in Savitri. Dr. Nadkarni used to say that the three most difficult words in Savitri are he, she, and it. So, but here and there are also among the words that we have to really see the context. And,
I wonder, though, that it's if these crises that come on Earth, the earthquakes and volcanoes, etc., are the movements of vital forces in nature. And that's why Earth can't understand them. Earth is peaceful on her own. She's not causing any trouble at all, actually. But it's these vital, even the lava that's in her home, it's from the vital world. Because it says Earth fears the stress.
Of those mighty signs, yes, those great intensities. Our earth trembles at the thought of them. No?
Is it trembling the thought, or is it some of the force from which the earth, the material earth, was made, just returning to force again? Isn't it a kind of a divine natural process? Not that the earth fearing, the earth just going back to what it came from.
These earthquakes are symbolic of this bliss which we cannot... this rapture, which we cannot bear, this brought by these very subtle touches on the heart's cords, in heaven's subtleties. And earthquakes and volcanoes are essential for life on Earth. They bring nutrients and that kind of thing. So we don't know that, we just suffer.
But since it's confusing, Shatavan, I would like to explain this, what she has read, like here, there, and other things.
One line kind of puts us in our place in relation to the absolute reality of the world. It was there. Our human pleasure is a fallen thread.
Yeah, there it's a comparison,
yeah.
No?
Yeah.
The lovelinesses, those raptures, which there were a common incident, no? Those lovelinesses of which our human pleasure is just a fallen thread. There they are beautiful embroideries, a careless ornament sewn on the rich brocade of Godhead's dress. So we just get a tiny little silk thread which gives us a touch of those lovelinesses. There they are fully expressed.
Yes, the Godhead is a big
tea. Yes, the bridge brocade. So we can say divinity if we want to translate it. Everything is a dress for divinity. Luba. Bottom line.
In this fashion, where the image holds, where mind arrive to fathom a deep physical dream. The heart was a torch lit from infinity. The limbs were trembling densities of soul. The world of frost dominates the outer contours.
Courts.
Courts, sorry. Immense, but least in range, and least in price, the slightest ecstasies of the undying voice. Higher, or swing of wisdom swept in me, admitted through large sapphire opening gates into the brightness of a light beyond. These were but
sumptuous
decorated doors towards nobler, more felicitously fair. Endless aspire the climbing of those heavens, realm upon realm receive for serene
being. Yes, thank you. Least in value. So, to understand this, we have to look back to page 672 and what we talked about last week, about the seven immortal earths. And at the bottom of page 672, we read that the lowest of these earths was still a heaven, translating into the splendor of things divine, the beauty and brightness of terrestrial scenes. So what we've been reading about since then is the description of the lowest of these earths. And what the first lines that Lyuba read, the first this first sentence that you read is actually the last sentence of that description. Yeah. There in that lowest of the heavens, things fashioned, things that are made, objects, were imaged homes where mind arrived to fathom a deep physical joy. It reminds me of something that Sri Aurobindo has written in the book that I still prefer to call The Foundations of Indian Culture, although its name has been officially changed, where he writes about the art of India, and he also deals with what we call crafts, things fashioned, things that are made. And he refers also in Savitri in a couple of places to the way in which something that's made, maybe for use, a cup or a vase or anything, how if the craftsman is sufficiently attuned to the higher and subtler worlds, divinity can be expressed in even these things fashioned. So that's what he's saying here. Things fashioned were imaged homes where mind arrived to fathom a deep physical joy. We can enter into the beauty of some fashioned thing. And it's physical, it's an enjoyment of the senses, but it has some much deeper dimension to it. And then he mentions the heart in that world is like a torch full of burning energy, a torch lit from infinity. The limbs of the bodies there, trembling densities of soul, concentrations of soul.
It's interesting, that the limbs were the trembling densities of soul, often the soul is connected to the consciousness.
Well, this is what eventually our limbs also should become.
Exactly.
When the transformation comes, the limbs should become densities of soul, condensations of soul. So then he's...
It's an impressionist image.
An impressionist.
I think the impressionist painter, like,
yeah,
fascist trembling.
Yes.
As make them vibrate to something else.
Yes, yes. So then he says what she was experiencing where nature was without fault, these were the first domains. They're like the entrance, the outer courts. Although they're so immense in range, and although they're the least in value, these are the slightest ecstasies of the undying gods. The closest to our material universe. So then Savitri looks higher her swing of vision swept, and it's admitted, it's allowed to enter through large sapphire opening gates as if the sky opens up. She's at her vision is admitted into the wideness of a light beyond. And then she recognizes that what she's standing in and experiencing are just sumptuous decorated doors, richly decorated doors to worlds that are even nobler, even more felicitously fair. And there's no limit, endless aspired the climbing of those heavens. Realm upon realm received her soaring view. Jean-Yves, you'll read.
Then, on what seemed one crown of the ascent, where finite and the infinite are one, immune she beheld the strong immortal seeds, who live for a celestial joy and rule, the middle regions of the unfading way. Great forms of deities sat in deathless tiles, eyes of the unborn gaze towards her, limned through transparency of crystal fire. And the beauty of bodies wrought from nature's lamps, shapes of entrancing sweetness, spilling bliss, fear. Glimmering upon the sandstone courts of mine, heavens kept balance, all round the eternal's wine. A tangle of bright bodies, of moved souls, tracing the close and entering the light, the harmonious trail of lives forever joined, and the passionate oneness of a mystic joy, as if sunbeams made living and divine, the golden bosom of Sarah goddesses, in rules flooded from an argent disk of lips that floated through luminous sapphire dreams, in a crown of raiment lit with golden leaves, and gleaming footfalls, trailing fading souls, urging motions of backing innocences, who know their right for a dance of God, world lives in wooden events of the heart.
Thank you. I think it is the seats that are immune.
Immune from what?
Immune from any kind of imperfection and any kind of attack. Okay. It is the strong immortal seats. They are immune. They are beyond our influence or touch. They're beyond any imperfection.
The seats are perfect for the immortals.
Both. But if we take it grammatically, it's applying to the seats.
Mm-hmm. And why did you come out? Oh, how did you?
What about sunstone? Is that an actual stone, or is a word you made up? Sunstone? Mm-hmm.
So, no, first let's deal with this transitional sentence. She's looking up and she's seeing this limitless series of worlds above. Realm upon realm received her soaring view. And then on what seemed one crown of the ascent. It's not all the way to the top. It's just some intermediate peak or summit. It's a crown and of the ascent where finite and the infinite are one. There's a meeting place of finiteness and infinity. That's where she sees the seats of the strong immortals. And the seats and the immortals themselves are immune, completely untouchable. But what they live for is a celestial joy and rule. So what she is seeing, or what she's focusing on, are the middle regions of the unfading ray. First she was in the lowest heaven, she looked up and saw many more, and now what she's focusing on is the middle regions, not the higher levels. And this seems to be a world of the gods. This is where great forms of deities are sitting, as they're imaged in the Greek Olympic heaven. Now that there's tiers, there's a hierarchy of gods, and they are sitting in tiers according to their rank, no? Deathless tiers. And they are looking down on her, eyes of an unborn gaze towards her turned through a transparency of crystal fire. That's the atmosphere through which they are looking at her. And what she sees is, first of all, the golden-bosomed Apsara goddesses, who in the Indian tradition, of course, are the dancers in Indra's court, in the court of Indra as the king of the gods. So beautiful description of these goddesses. Their bodies has been shaped from rapture. Shapes of entrancing sweetness, spilling bliss. Feet glimmering upon the sunstone courts of mind. So this is a reference perhaps to Indra as the god of mind. He's the god of sky, of mind. And heaven's cupbearers, there are servants who carry around the wine to the gods for them to drink with. In the Greek heaven, this is the nectar that keeps the gods immortal, this drink of so full of delight that they cannot age. No? So first the Apsaras, but first it's these beautiful, youthful cup bearers. And then she sees dancing in a tangle of bright bodies, which correspond to moved souls. What they are doing with the steps of their dance is to trace the close and intertwined delight, the harmonious tread of lives forever joined in the passionate oneness of a mystic joy. That's what they're expressing with their movements. These are the golden-bosomed Apsara goddesses. And where are they dancing? In groves flooded from an argent disk of bliss, like a full moon in a sapphire sky, a lumen that floated through a luminous sapphire dream. And their raiment, their covered with robes, golden raiment, raiment that is lit. We can see through the raiment their golden limbs, the light of their bodies. And their footfalls, steps of their feet are gleaming. He speaks about the brightness of Savitri's feet. The feet of these golden goddesses must be even more luminous as they are treading on swards, grass. Swards are grass, lawns, smooth, soft grass. That's what they are dancing on.
And this fairy.
Fairy. So this is a poetic way of spelling the adjective fairy, which has to do with these magical beings from the subtle realms. Whenever he uses it, Sri Aurobindo uses this old spelling, which we find in the English epic, the Fairy Queen. This is from the Elizabethan era. It's somehow much more poetic to spell it this way than to spell it in the other way. And their movements are innocent. These are virgin motions of Bacchant innocences. The Bacchants are the worshippers of Dionysus, the god of delight, of divine intoxication. But here these are innocent revels, no? Because these dancers know that although they may be dancing very vigorously, maybe their revel may be even called a riot, it's still a dance of God. It's inspired and moved and offered to God. So there they are, whirled, moving around in moonlit revels of the heart. There's something specially magical about these moonlit revels. And of course it reminds us of Krishna's revels with the gopis, which were also danced in the forest under the light of the moon.
I want to express some experience, my inner experience in the dance before Kiribaya Yama Urtapak. And Mohini come to me, and I take the Shiva head in front of me, I offer to Shobina and Amanda. And 4 hours non-stop, I'm dancing in my studio in our model for Playboy. And he received my prayer through my dance.
Through your dance, yes.
When his heart attack is...
Heart attack.
Yeah.
Heart.
He's not very country. I tell, I receive. When I open my eyes.
We don't perhaps always see the inner significance of dance movements. But I have a couple of examples myself. One is that when Mother was working with Huta on the paintings of Book 1, Canto 2, there's a description of Savitri's heart as dancing like a priestess. No? And for Mother had been making drawings for each of the pictures, sketches, but for that one she didn't. She stood in front of Huta in a dance pose, and that is what Huta has painted.
Mother herself stood.
Sorry?
Mother herself stood.
Mother herself stood and took that dance pose, and then Huta had to sketch that and use that as the basis for her painting of this priestess who represents Savitri's heart. That's one thing. Another thing is a more personal experience. When I first came in contact with Mother and Sri Aurobindo, through somebody who had been here in the ashram. And one night in dream, I felt myself very much under attack by hostile forces. And when I called to Mother, then I saw a figure of this man in the Shiva pose, Shiva Nataraj pose. And that destroyed all those goblins completely. Nice, no? So these movements, these mudras, these positions, they all have power and significance. Well, what I have to say about this section of Savitri as a whole, I mean, book 11, and very particularly the first part of it up to the climax of the poem, and including the climax of the poem, this is poetry such has never been written or heard before. It's the whole of Savitri, of course, is mantric. All of it is powerful. All of it is illumining. But here he is doing something different. And Nirod tells us that when the dictation of this book was going on, it seemed as if Sri Aurobindo did the composing in his consciousness during the night, and Nirod would come in the morning, and Sri Aurobindo would just dictate line after line after line after line, sometimes 500 lines at a stretch, Nirod says. So he was just carrying all this. No? And it can't be compared to any other kind of poetry that has ever been written, even by Sri Aurobindo himself. I find it completely different. And as I said last week, that makes it difficult to say anything about it in any other words than the words he has used.
The word argent means silver.
Silver, yes, so it refers to the full moon.
This word immune, I thought maybe it means that when she's in this state, seeing these things, she is immune.
I considered that, but I don't think it refers to Savitri. I think it refers to what she sees. So also inhabiting that heaven, then, there are the Gandharvas, the heavenly musicians. You read, Mihong?
Impeccable artists of unerring forms, magician readers of sound and rhythmic words, wind-haired Gandharvas chanted to the ear, the oaths that shade the universal thought, the lines that tear the veil from the deity's face, the rhythms that bring the sound of the wisdom's sea, immortal figures and illumined brows, our great forefathers in those splendors moved, timeless, empowered and satisfied of light. They enjoyed the sense of all for which we strive. High seers moved to poets, so the eternal thought that travelers from on high arrived to us, deformed by our search, tricked by costuming mind, like a ghost disfigured by the pangs of birth, these the great words which now a free sound caught by difficult rapture on a mortal tongue. the strong who stumble, and seen who have come proud gods.
Thank you. So there are other kinds of beings there accompanying the apsaras. They are these impeccable artists of unerring forms. What they create is simply perfect. Magician builders of sound and rhythmic words. These are the Gandharvas, wind-haired Gandharvas. I think in the imagery, Gandharvas float in the air, if I'm right. They are chanting the odes, the odes, the words and rhythms that shape the universal thought, the lines that tear the veil from deity's face. They reveal the divine. They use the rhythms that bring the sounds of wisdom's sea, the ocean, the rhythmic ocean of wisdom. Also there are our great forefathers who are referred to in the Vedas, no, as the ones who went before, the great forefathers. There, now they are in their immortal forms. And they are termless in power, full of power and satisfied of light, full of light. They are enjoying the sense, the meaning of everything that we strive for and that they strove for when they were human beings on earth. There it is, they are enjoying that great achievement. And then there are the rishis, the high seers, moved poets. They are seeing the eternal thoughts. Those eternal thoughts do come to us, travelers from on high. They come to earthly poets, but they arrive to us deformed by our search. We don't see them in their perfect forms. Something gets damaged on the way. And then when they arrive to us, they get tricked by costuming mind. Here, tricked doesn't mean cheated, it means dressed up. The mind gives them costumes to these eternal thoughts. So they appear like gods disfigured by the pangs of birth. Those poets there seized the great words which now for us are frail sounds caught by difficult rapture on a mortal tongue. All achievement here in our world, even if it's rapturous effort, it demands effort. And then just in one line, also there, the strong who stumble and sin were calm, proud gods. There they have reached their fulfillment.
So I have one question to this. High seers, moved poets, saw the eternal thoughts. And that, is it also how it is also the behind the meaning that of the supreme divine, or it is only...
No, the eternal thoughts that arrive to us, we have to... go to the end of the line. They arrive to us as travelers from on high. They arrive to us because we've been calling for them, but they are deformed by our search, and they get dressed up by our costuming mind. So now they arrive to us like gods, disfigured by the pangs of birth. No?
That refers to the thoughts.
Yes. But the high seers, moved poets, saw the eternal thoughts and seized the great words, which now are frail sounds caught by difficult rapture on a mortal tongue. This may be something like the Overmind, yes. Yes.
By costuming minds, it means our mind is divided and compartmentalized.
No, those thoughts and dress them up in words. They costume them, and these decorating, and that's superfluous, actually.
We all preconceived ideas, we decorate.
Yes, yes. And Mother has spoken about this, of course, that usually we just think with words. But it is possible, if we can quieten the mind, we can receive ideas, complete ideas, which could get expressed in many different words and ways. And she said the highest thing is to think in experiences. But if the mind can be silent enough, then those things come with their own words. We don't have to costume them, dress them up. We don't have to deform them with our minds. The mind can just receive. And that's what perhaps these high seers and moved poets were doing. They're receiving the true, full expression, the mantra. No?
And not only, it's an effect when she had been there, is that all my experience at 26, the very glorious spirit that ashram started, with high-level poetry written by the ashram, and suddenly they start to realize they have to go
into the subconscious.
Yes, and they stop with it, and that glorious period of expression and everything stops.
Yes. Yes, because of that.
Because he, with his super consciousness, he could finally have that undeformed thought expression.
Exactly. Yes.
You got a question as a poet from one who expressed what you did. And I don't know much about poetry, but I think Schaubinder is not so, he's how well known he is among the most famous poets that you can express the most special poetry that he's in. Is that maybe because he writes from his overmind consciousness and we cannot grasp it and recognize it?
That's what he himself has said, that, this is the poetry of the future, and it's written for the future. And he says we can't expect a large appreciative audience for some time. You know? But then he said, but perhaps in India there may be some response. I feel the response in India has been rather ignorant and relatively unappreciative, except in this growing circle of the Aurobindonian family. But some English academics have surprised me by being able to appreciate this. And I know also of one French professor, his student, Leslie Travens, she was here and she met me, and she said that he was her supervisor for her thesis, which she wrote about Schaubinder. And he thanked her for introducing him to Savitri. You know. So here and there are receptive people. And I hope that what we are doing here is preparing the audience that can appreciate, a wider audience that can appreciate what Sri Aurobindo has done. Although we are appreciating it very, very imperfectly, I feel, but at least we're trying.
Yeah, regarding his level considered, what I've heard, you can confirm it, that when Sri Rabindranath Tagore was being considered for a Nobel Prize, he was also considered. But he could not, because people didn't understand what was written. It was recommended, but then finally, Rabindranath Tagore got it, a great poet, but
since you've mentioned Rabindranath, in connection with this passage, I always remember him. Because I remember in my early days in Oroville, somebody from the ashram who used to come to Aspiration School, Shatadal, he has treated us to a recitation of some of Tagore's poems in Bengali.
Amazing.
I thought, this is the tongue of the Gandharvas. I was so moved, so beautiful.
But is it true that he was being considered for the Nobel Prize?
Sri Aurobindo was considered for the Nobel Prize, possibly on two occasions, but I believe it was for the Life Divine.
Gabriela Mistral, the poet of Chile, when she received, she offered, saying that Sri Aurobindo is the one, she was reading the Light Divine, but was in general like a poet. But he passed away and the mother didn't want to accept it, because it was passed to the mother and she didn't, because she could, no? And she said, no, that's not it. She was already knowing it was Sri Aurobindo.
I think he was proposed for the Nobel Prize for the Life Divine in 1942. And then that year, no Nobel Prize was awarded because the Nazis invaded Norway. But just recently I came to know that perhaps in 1949 there was a second proposal.
I was amazed because when she passed away, it was in her night table, the Bible and the Life Divine always. I was really shocked for that. I didn't know.
She is from which country? She's
Chile.
Gabriela Mistral.
A teacher and a poet.
She had herself been given the Nobel Prize for poetry.
She proposed Sri
So I think that's where we stop for today. We've got more delights to follow next week. Yes, we will listen to Mother's voice.
Immortal harmony filled her listening ear. A great spontaneous utterance of the heights on Titan's wing of rhythmic grandeur born. Fall on something, give your heart a sound, strange, trembling with the secrets of the God. In the harmony of the non-visible sight, she saw all nature marvelous without fault. Endless as far the climbing of the heavens. Rain upon rain, rushing her soaring view. In noon she beheld the strong immortal seeds who live for a celestial joy and hope. The middle regions of the unfading rain, great forms of dating set
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.